grab your beverages and turn up your interweb. Solving the world's problems 12 ounces at a time. It's Dudes and Beer. Well, hello everybody, and welcome to episode 334 of the Dudes and Beer podcast. Chris Jordan coming to you live from Austin, Texas, soon to be on the road. We do actively have shows on the books, finally, after like a year or so, but of course, a lot of local shows are canceling here in Austin. We have hit stage 5 once again. Here in COVID land. So take care of yourselves, folks. Take care of your families. You know, do what's right for you. That's all I'm going to say. That's it. Everybody knows where I stand on things. And I don't really like, you know, like really going crazy about it. Let's just say it that way. So while you're online tonight, checking everything out, make sure to stop on by the Dudes and Beer podcast. Dudesandbeer.com is where you can find everything. That is where you can find all of the episodes. That's where you can find everything Dudes and Beer related, including the store where you can buy all of our guest books. While you're online there checking that out, make sure to stop on by Curious Realm. Curious Realm is our brand new skin, folks. That's what we're going to be living in come December. We have had a great run as Dudes and Beer. Shout out to Cheryl Goodman, longtime listener of the show. Because of people like you, Cheryl, we have grown to such a great extent that we literally have to rebrand the show now. So Curious Realm is what we will be coming December. I can't wait. Don't worry. There will always be a beer crack somewhere hidden in the intro, just as homage to the show and where we started. Our guests tonight are going to be fantastic. Our first guest comes to us from LITM Media. Shout out to Michelle. I love having your guests on, lady. Please keep in touch always. Michael Dank, author of the Into the Rabbit Hole series, available not only on his website, but also on Amazon and in our store, will be on tonight talking about the study of astrotheology and other esoteric topics such as that. The idea of astrology being used in theology, the idea of astrology being used in the Bible. Those topics coming up in the first part of the show. In the second part of the show, our good friend, Dudes and Beer member, as well as former guest, Stephen Myers, author of The Lost Technologies of the Great Pyramid, as well as The Great Pyramid Prosperity Machine, will be joining us to talk about the construction of the Great Pyramid of Giza, his hypothesis to it, new discoveries that have happened in the world of Egyptology that, you know, may very well be heading his way as far as proving that. While you're online checking out his website, thepump.org, make sure to stop on by the Dudes and Beer Facebook group. That is where you can find all of the articles that we post every week for our News of the Week section that we do right here on the show. That's also where the conversation goes on. In addition to our announcements, for upcoming guest announcement, we will soon be having a great segment featuring former guest Richard Adams, as well as other people from a great technology company doing like virtual medicine. They've actually just put some stuff up on the ISS, so that's going to be wicked cool. In addition to that, out of NBC News, Newsmax AONN sued by the maker of the voting machines due to their conspiracy theory, in air quotes. Out of Singularity Hub, magnetizable concrete in roads could charge electric cars while you drive. That is amazing news. Here's a kind of sad one if it turns out to be true. But interesting engineering, as well as another source that I posted in our group today, has come out saying that SpaceX is launching a satellite that will display billboard ads from space. So imagine going out to, you know, like, enjoy the Pleiadian meteor shower, you know, or the Perseids that are coming up right up around my birthday every year, that kind of stuff. And it's like, oh, yeah, let's go out and, oh, look, Starlink's about to get out of the way now, you know. So now that Starlink's out of the way, oh, wait, here comes the ad before the top of the hour when the meteor shower starts. So imagine that kind of stuff. Stories like that are what we carry over in the Dudes and Beer Facebook group. That is the conversation. Another huge one was at a Science Alert, a key hallmark of motor neuron disease has been reversed in the lab. For the first time, they have actually been able to reverse the effects of this on the human brain. So stop on by, check it out. Facebook.com is, of course, the site. Curious Realm, formerly Dudes and Beer Podcast. You can either search for Dudes and Beer, and I guarantee you it will pop up, or you can stop on by and search Curious Realm, and it will pop up. Of course, while you're on there, make sure to stop on by our fantastic sponsors, True Hemp Science. They are the makers of some of the best CBD product out there. I have traveled the country for years as an AV tech, and literally have used Chris's product. Granted, Chris knows I've cheated on him. He knows that whenever I go out amongst other cities in the country, that I try stuff from local manufacturers. I try things from all over the place because I want to see what the local's all about. His is by far the best product that I have found. Stop on by True Hemp Science today. Dudes 7 is the code that you want to use to save 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more. And in addition to saving 7% off your entire cart of $50 or more, you will get two free 25 milligram edibles, either cookies or brownies, on your way out the door. Stop on by the website once again, truehempscience.com. The code that you want to use, Dude7. While we are on the topic of sponsors, let's get shameless one last time with this plug from our sponsor, Podcast Cadet, before we welcome our first guest for the evening, the incredible author and researcher, Micah Dank. Have you considered starting a podcast? Looking for a way to make your business a voice of authority in an industry? Then Podcast Cadet is the solution for you. Whether starting a podcast for yourself, your brand, business, school, church, or just plain fun, Podcast Cadet is here to help you navigate the waters of the podcast industry. Specializing in one-on-one consultation and training with industry professionals in fields ranging from podcast technology and editing to distribution, monetization, and even social media strategies, Podcast Cadet tailors their services to the specific needs of you and your podcast. Do you already have a podcast and trying to find ways to engage and grow your audience? Sign up for your Podcast Cadet audit today and let us help you explore new and exciting ways to leverage your content and elevate your podcast brand to whole new levels. From consultational workshops to affordable podcast production and maintenance packages, Podcast Cadet is your one-stop shop for everything podcast-related on the internet. Visit PodcastCadet.com today to sign up for your consultation or training and use code DUDES20 to save 20% off your entire purchase. That website again is PodcastCadet.com. That's right, folks. PodcastCadet.com is the website that you want to visit. Full disclosure, I am one of the owners of Podcast Cadet. The whole reason that I started that was to quite literally help people be able to get their message out there for businesses, churches, whatever. I have worked in the broadcast world for years and I'm a live AV tech, and it hurt me sometimes to see some of the advice that people got. So it was fantastic to actively be able to get together with other people and help people out, be able to get people started on the right foot. So stop on by, check that out. Dudes20 is the code that you want to use whenever you stop by. Our guest this evening, welcome to the show, Micah Dank. How are you doing this evening, good sir?
I'm well. How are you?
Doing fantastic. I cannot wait to get into the topic of astrology, astro, theology, all kinds of good stuff. Before we do, let's get into you, Micah Dank. Let's find out real quick how you got into researching this topic, how you came to doing all of this, and what brought you to writing the series of books that you had. Because it's not just one book. It's quite literally a series of books, the Into the Rabbit Hole series. Let's start getting into that real quick.
So in 2013, I had moved to Boston. I'm from Long Island, and I live in Long Island again, but I moved to Boston for a job. I moved there with an ex I'm no longer with. And we got up there, and we didn't really have a lot of friends yet or anything. So it was just basically her watching TV a lot of the time and me on the iPad that had just come out. Like the iPad had just come out in 2013. So I was on it and I was scrolling and I was going down rabbit holes, and I came across some videos on astrotheology, and it just blew my mind. And what I did was I started studying these guys, Jordan Maxwell and Santos Bonocchi, for months. Months, I would just listen to them for hours and hours a day, and I would study it. And then it came to the point where I got a good grasp on like the zodiac and the decoding and everything, and I started branching out doing my own work on it. And then I decided at some point I wanted to write a book about it. And then I kind of tossed around the idea of whether or not to write a nonfiction book, or, you know, but it occurred to me that nonfiction books aren't really fun reads. You know, maybe it's a very niche audience. It's a very niche audience. So if you need, you know, certain people gravitate to it, but not much. So I decided to write a thriller series about this topic because nobody had done that before. So I kind of like carved out my own path with that. And I ended up writing six thrillers that surround about this. And basically, the purpose of the books is to show that the elites rule the world with astrology. And I basically go into that and how that works. And I talk about a lot of conspiracy theories and things of that nature. But that's kind of what I did.
Well, and let's start getting into that real quick, because once again, the world of astrology has been interesting to me since I was a kid. I was probably in about sixth or seventh grade when I started. I'm 45 now. When I first started reading about astrology, when I first started reading about ancient talismans, magic, voodoo. What was interesting is my mom, I think my mom was just happy I was reading anything. Because I definitely wasn't like, you know, the best. I was definitely a solid C student, you know, something along those lines. But I wasn't like my brother, who poured through a couple few novels a month, that kind of stuff as a kid, you know. So the fact that I was reading anything she was happy about, and this stuff just, it captured my imagination and was something that I've just vehemently studied for years. So for me, talking astrology, zodiac, the zodiac across cultures, that kind of stuff, is not that foreign. But for those of our audience who may not even realize the difference between astrology and astronomy and the basis of one and another, let's start breaking that apart for them real quick.
Okay. So astronomy is basically studying of the stars. Okay. But astrology is grouping together of stars and the myths around it. You have signs like Aquarius, you have signs like Pisces, you have signs like Aries. And it's basically astrology has to do basically with that, with the 12 zodiac signs. I can go over the 12 signs and tell you a little bit of my work if you'd like at some point.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Please feel free. We can start right there. I think that's a great way to start, because I think quite a bit of our audience, of course, has probably gone to the Quickie Mart down the road and, you know, purchased an astrological scroll at some point in their life or run across it in their local newspaper, you know, but there's a difference between actual astrology and just straight like zodiac prediction. So let's kind of start getting into that real quick.
That's fine. Okay, so you have to understand is the idea behind astrotheology is basically this. It's prevalent throughout the Bible. The astrology is hidden within the Bible. You have to understand the codes in order to decode them. In the New Testament, astrotheology basically says that Jesus is the sun, S-U-N, of God, the sun in the sky, not the S-O-N. That is just a wordplay. And basically, it's Jesus, it's the sun going through the 12 zodiac signs. And I'm going to go through some of this stuff and it's going to start to make a little more sense. But let me start with the signs. So,
sure.
What I'm going to do now is going through the 12 signs and I'm going to tell you what keywords you need to look for. That's how you know what they're talking about. So, the first sign I talk about is Aquarius, which is represented by the man with the water pitcher. Okay. So, anytime you ever hear the words son of man or man, because Aquarius is the man sign, or picture, or baptism, because this is how you baptize someone with you pour the water out of the pitcher onto their head. Fountain, flowing waters, for example, they're talking about Aquarius. Then Pisces is a sign of the two fish in the water. Then Aries is the ram. And in Aries, you have March 21st, which is the spring equinox. It's a 12-hour day, 12-hour night. It's also the Passover. So the Jews celebrate the Passover on Nisan 14 in the Jewish calendar. That's in Aries. The Passover is God passing over Egypt and smiting the firstborn children. It's the 10th plague in order for Moses to get everybody out in Exodus. However, in astrotheology, the Passover is literally that. The sun passes over the equator and back on its way up to its height in the summer solstice. So days get longer, nights get shorter, things get warmer, the grass starts to grow. In Christianity, the passing over is changed, and it's called the resurrection of God's Son. As in Aries, you had Easter, too. So you have the Passover and the resurrection of God's Son. It's it's basically two ways of describing the same thing. And the Jewish people are the people of Aries, okay? When the Bible was written, the Old Testament, that was the time of Aries. And Aries is the ram, and that's why the Jews still blow the ram's horn to the sky during the high holidays, is because it's Aries worship.
Sure.
Then Taurus is the bull. And when you look at the sky and you see Taurus during the season where it's supposed to be, you know that you need to put the plow on the bull so that you can plant the seed so you can harvest in Virgo and Libra. So anytime you hear the words cow or calf or bull or ox, they're talking about Taurus. Then Gemini is the sign of the twins. It's Castor and Pollux Troy, whose sister was Helen of Troy. It's the story of Achilles. Then Cancer is the crab, and the crab is the sideways moving creature. If you've ever seen a crab move, it kind of shuffles to the side. The reason Cancer is the crab is because June 21st, the summer solstice, is in Cancer. Okay, and the reason it's the crab is because the sun shuffles to the side as well. So what happens is starting on December 25th, it rises a degree on its axis. Then the next day, it'll rise an additional degree. And then it continues to rise a degree every single day until it hits June 21st. Once it hits June 21st, okay, that's the summer solstice. It's the longest day of the year, the shortest night. Then for three consecutive days after that, it rises to the same degree, moving it sideways. And then on June 25th, it lowers a degree. And then it continues to lower a degree every day until it hits December 21st. December 21st is the day of death. Anytime they're talking about death in the Bible, it's a metaphor for December 21st, which is Sagittarius. I'm going to get into that in a little bit. But basically, just like the sun shuffles for 3 days, the sun doesn't rise on its axis above the horizon on December 21st. So the ancients used to say God's sun was dead. Then for 3 days, it shuffles to the same side. It doesn't rise on its axis. So that's how it became God's sun was dead for 3 days. The sun, the literal sun, was dead for 3 days. And then on December 25th, it comes back to life. And what happens is it comes back to life. And that's why on December 25th is the birthday of all the gods. Tammuz, Horus, Jesus, Mithra, Dagon. You can go into all of these, you know, but this is why they're all celebrated on December 25th, because the sun comes back to life. It's a celebration. Then Leo is the king. He's the lion. He's the king of the jungle. The ruling planet of Leo is actually the sun. So when the sun is in Leo, that's its kingdom. That's its home. So anytime you hear the word lion or lioness or cub, they're talking about Leo. Then Virgo is the woman holding the wheat stalk. So remember before when you said that you plant in Taurus? Well, you plant in Taurus when you see the bull. And then in Virgo, the virgins would cultivate the wheat in Virgo. That's why it's a woman holding the wheat stalk. That's why that's the sign of Virgo. It's because the virgins would go out during Virgo and cultivate the wheat in order to make the bread for the year. So anytime you hear the word virgin or woman or young woman or wheat or barley or mustard seed or grain or things of that nature, they're talking about Virgo. Then Libra is the justice. It's the scales, it's the balance, it's the just one. And the reason it's justice is because you remember how in Aries it's celebrated the sun goes over the equator?
Yep.
Well, in Libra, you have the fall equinox, which is when the sun drops below the equator. So it's kind of mourned. Okay, so Libra is the justice, it's the scale. So what happens is in Libra, it judges God's sun as it passes over the fall equinox and begins its descent into cold, into winter, into death. Okay, so anytime you hear justice or judgment or judge, the just one, law, marriage, divorce, tax, things of lawly nature, they're talking about Libra. Libra is also wine and olive season. Okay, that's when you grab them, and that's when you grab the grapes and you press them into wine in Libra. Okay, so anytime you hear the word wine or vineyard or wine press or vine or olive oil, they're talking about Libra. So Virgo is the bread and Libra is the wine. That's the bread and the wine. Those are the symbols of Christianity. Then Scorpio is the scorpion, and he is known as the betrayer. Because when a scorpion bites you, it leaves an imprint in your skin that looks like two lips. It's why the mafia has the kiss of death. That's what it goes back to. Mafia has the kiss of death because Scorpio is the betrayer. So it's why Jesus was betrayed by Judas with a kiss. Jesus is the sun, okay? And Judas is one of the 12 disciples or one of the 12 zodiac signs. And Judas is the betrayer. That's why he's Scorpio. So the sun is judged in Libra and it's betrayed in Scorpio. And then finally in Sagittarius, this is where the bow and the arrow shoot the sun and inflict further punishment on the sun, okay? And in Sagittarius, I mentioned you had December 21st. Okay, so anytime you hear the word bow, arrow, horse, spear, things of that nature, they're talking about Sagittarius. And then finally, the last sign is Capricorn. It's the goat. Because if you think about the zodiac wheel that you see on the left of your screen right now,
yep.
Okay, let me take a closer look at it real quick. Now, it's kind of out of order, but where you see Capricorn is,
yep.
Okay, where Capricorn is, that should be on the bottom, okay? Capricorn should be on the bottom. And if you picture the sun climbing a degree a day along the outskirts of the zodiac wheel, okay, that's basically what it does, is it climbs the mountain, just like the goats climb the mountain. That's why it's a goat. So those are the 12 signs of the zodiac. And now that I've given you the words, the keywords to look for, we can begin decoding some passages and go into some further information to prove this case. If you have any questions.
Sorry about that. A lot of this, like I was just saying on mute accidentally, was that I'm of course familiar with some of these teachings through my studies of esoteric knowledge and horoscope itself, and of course through my study of Bible, Kabbalah, things like that. But let's go ahead and start cracking the nut real quick on the idea of passages of the Bible referring to these, because now granted, a lot of people, trigger alert folks, is all I can say, because this is going to of course challenge a lot of people's norm, let's just say, when it comes to biblical scholarship, biblical teaching, as far as the words themselves. Now that does not mean that much like many other parts of the Bible, many other books of the Bible, things like the Revelation of John, that kind of stuff, that people are not speaking in a code or speaking in a language that was meant to be understood by a select few. So
right.
Let's specifically start getting into passages like you were talking okay. about that really bring these zodiacal signs to bear.
Okay. Let me start with names for Jesus first, if that's okay.
Oh, most definitely.
Okay. So Jesus is the Son of God. Remember, he's the Son. So when the Son is in Capricorn, the sign of the goat, his name is the scapegoat of Israel. When the Sun is in Aquarius, the man, he's known as the Son of Man. When the Sun's in Pisces, the two fish, he's known as the Fisherman of Men. It's also why he fed the masses with two fish on the mound. It's a metaphor. When the Sun is in Aries, he's known as the Lamb of God or the Good Shepherd. When the Sun is in Leo, he's known as the Lion of Judah. The lady holding the stalk of wheat, Virgo, he's born of a virgin and he's called the Bread of Life. Libra, the scales of justice, he's known as the Just One. Every sign, there's a name for him, as you can see.
Yeah, yeah, precisely. And even to go into the Lion of the tribe of Judah.
Right. So if we start going into some decodings, Proverbs 16:18, have you ever heard of the phrase, pride comes before the fall?
Oh, absolutely.
Can you explain it to your audience?
The basic gist of it that most people interpret it as is the fact of you get too haughty, you're going to have a little bit of a problem.
Right. However,
yeah.
You know what a group of lions is called?
Oh, well, a pride, of course.
Okay, so pride is the lion and lion is Leo, right?
Yep.
Leo is in July and August. That comes before the fall.
Wow. There you go.
Okay. Now, in the book of Micah, my namesake, Micah 5:2, is where Micah predicts, or he says that the Savior is going to come from a town called Bethlehem. But you, Bethlehem Ephrathah, though you are small among the clans of Judah, out of you will come for me one who will be ruler over Israel, whose origins are from old, from ancient times. However, in Hebrew, do you know what the word Bethlehem means?
No, offhand I do not.
Bethlehem is a combination of two words in Hebrew. It's Bet, B-E-T, which means house, and Lechem, Lechem means bread. So it's the house of bread. So you go back to your Virgo sign, that's the lady with the wheat stalk. Each zodiac sign is called a house. A house, an eon, a mansion, an age. There's many different words for it in the Bible. So when he's saying that the Savior will come from the house of bread or Bethlehem, it means that the Savior will come from a virgin. You see how that works?
Oh, absolutely.
All right. Now, I've given you the keywords to look for things, right? So I'm going to go over this with you right now. Tell me how many you pick up on. This is Deuteronomy 32. It says, he gave them honey from the cliffs and olive oil from the rocky grounds. He gave his people butter from the herd and milk from the flock. He gave them lambs and goats. They had the best rams from Bashan and the finest wheat. They drank the best wine made from the juice of red grapes. But Jeshurun became fat and kicked like a bull. So you see how many signs are just in that one passage?
Yeah, yeah. Interesting.
Now there's a couple that I didn't go over with you. He gave them honey from the cliffs. In the sign of Cancer, there's a group of stars called the Beehive Cluster. It's an asterism. It's a closely knit group of stars. It's called the Beehive Cluster. So that's where your honey comes from. And he gave his people butter from the herd and milk from the flock. Well, that comes from the Milky Way galaxy, okay, whose center is in Sagittarius. So following this train of thought, from the land of Cancer to Sagittarius is your land of milk and honey, if that makes sense.
Oh, absolutely. Wow. Wow.
Okay. And now, yeah, I'm sorry, go on.
Oh, no. I was just going to say, what an amazing way, especially for the culture at the time, to be able to remember these things for proper planting, proper care. Right. So many times on this show, we talk about especially the teachings of the Judaic people and things like the Ten Commandments, how they were specifically written for a tribal culture, for a culture right. that they're a great set of rules that's easy to remember for a bunch of people living in a caravan.
Right. And the truth of the matter is that the Ten Commandments, actually everything is lifted from the Egyptian times. The yep. Ten Commandments comes from something called the 12 Negative Confessions,
yeah.
which is in chapter 125 of the Book of the Dead of the Egyptians. The Ten Commandments are lifted straight from there.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's just it, to see how these things tie together as a narrative, and to see how these astrological signs and houses and the way that these words are tied together could very easily tie a narrative together that right. teaches people when to plant properly, when to harvest properly, you know, mm-hmm. how long to store things.
Because that's what they had to do. It's basically, the Bible is just a farmer's almanac. It's an encoded farmer's almanac.
It's a great way to put it.
It's an encoded farmer's almanac. That's what it is. You had to know when to plant. If you didn't know when to plant, if you didn't look at the bull and you didn't notice the bull and you didn't know, okay, it's time to plant on the you get the bowl, plant, you're not going to harvest in Virgo and Libra. You're going to starve in winter. You had to know when the sun was going to come out. You know, the sun tells the hour of the day. The moon tells the day of the month. Okay. Yeah. And the zodiac tells the month of the year. It's a perfect calendar.
Yeah. And, you know, it's really interesting to hear this interpretation, because I've of course heard this in some way, shape or form, that's part of the reason why the zodiac existed, of course, but I've never heard this in biblical terms, and it is really interesting right. to tie the two worlds together. Let's start exploring right. that a little bit deeper.
Sure. Okay, so you have the Mount of Olives, okay? So Jesus led his disciples to the Mount of Olives after his last Passover, so he could teach them a few more things, pray, then wait for Judas to betray him. While walking to the Mount of Olives, he gave the parable of the true vine. So pull back up the zodiac real quick.
Okay.
Okay, I see it. Okay, good. All right. So now Passover takes place in Aries, as I mentioned. So find Aries on the zodiac.
Okay.
Okay. What is its cross sign?
Cross sign would be Libra.
Exactly. Okay. Olives are in Libra. He goes to the Mount of Olives. So when they decode things in the Bible, okay, when you encode things in the Bible, it's always talking about the cross sign, because opposing signs are important, or the neighboring sign. So they were in Aries for Passover. Now they're at the Mount of Olives in Libra. These are opposing signs, okay? They're in Libra, and what are they doing? They're waiting for Judas to betray him, okay? Do you remember when the betrayer is?
The betrayer is Scorpio.
Which is the next sign over from Libra. So yeah. You see how it went across, and then it yep. went next. Now, while in Libra, he gave the parable of the true vine, or vineyard, or wine press, or Libra.
Sure.
Okay, so this is how they're encoded. Okay, and I'm going to go deeper into this kind of stuff. Okay?
Sure.
Now, Revelation 4:7, you're going to have to pull the wheel back up.
Okay.
Revelation 4:7, okay? The first living creature was like a lion. That's Leo. The second was like an ox. That's Taurus. The third had a face like a man. Okay, that's Aquarius. The fourth was like a flying eagle. Okay, this is in Revelation. Now, in astrology, okay, I can go into this deeper later, but in astrology, the Scorpion is the belly crawling creature. It's known as the lowest form of life on Earth, much like the snake was made to crawl on his belly after the deception in the Garden of Eden.
Yep.
However, in astrology, the evolved form of the Scorpio is the eagle, which is the flying eagle, which is the highest flying animal on Earth. It's the highest form of life. Okay. So now, the first living creature was like a lion, Leo. The second was like an ox, that's Taurus. The third had a face like a man, that's Aquarius. The fourth was like a flying eagle. Okay. The ox and Taurus and Scorpio, the flying eagle, are opposing signs. Okay. The face like a man, Aquarius, and the living creature was like a lion, okay? Leo and Aquarius, those are opposing signs. Those make an X through the zodiac wheel. They're the four fixed signs of the zodiac. So you have things like mutable signs and cardinal signs. You have fixed signs. These are fixed in their season. They're in the dead of their season, okay? If you look at the zodiac wheel, and if Capricorn's at the bottom and Cancer's on top, okay, if you draw a line between the solstices and the equinox, it makes a perfect cross through the wheel. That's the cross of God's son that he lives and dies on.
Hmm.
Okay. Now, Revelation 12. a great sign appeared in the heaven. Have you heard of the story of the woman with the dragon?
Oh, absolutely.
A great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and a crown of 12 stars on her head. She was pregnant and cried out in pain as she was about to give birth. Then another sign appeared in heaven, an enormous red dragon with 7 heads, 10 horns, and 7 crowns on its head. Its tail swept a third of the stars out of the sky and flung them to earth. Now, a woman clothed with the sun is a metaphor for the sun being in Virgo. It's clothed. Make sense?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay. Now, these are all metaphors. These are deep metaphors that have to be decoded. But now, if the sun is in Virgo, okay, the sun spends 2 hours a day in each sign. That's 12 signs. That's a 24-hour day clock. Yep. If the sun's in Virgo, like I just mentioned, that's roughly from 4 to 6 p.m., okay? And the sun is out. So if the sun is out, the moon will be at her feet. If the moon is out, the sun will be at her feet. Make sense?
Sure.
Okay. Now another sign appeared in heaven, an enormous dragon. Its tail swept a third of the stars out of the sky and flung them to earth. Have you heard of the constellation Draco?
Oh, absolutely.
Draco's the dragon. Okay. Yep. Its tail, okay, goes from Aries to Sagittarius, which is 4/12 of the signs or 1/3 of the stars out of the sky. This is just star poetry. That's all this stuff is. It's just metaphors.
Wow. Wow. All right. Well, let's get into some more of these metaphors and some more examples of where this astrotheology comes into play and where it leads us literally down the rabbit hole, Micah.
Okay. So if I go into Job 38, so do you remember the story of Job?
One of my favorites in the Bible.
Okay, so Job is the oldest book in the Bible. It's older than Genesis, okay? It is the first book that was written. Now, can you explain to your listeners who Job was and what his story kind of was?
Sure, sure. In a nutshell, Job was just a regular guy. He was not necessarily even one of the chosen people of Israel. He was just a regular guy who had favor with God because he praised God in everything that he did. He was granted great bounty in field, in crop, in family, in cattle, all kinds of things. And then suddenly one day, the devil pops up in heaven and goes, So you think this Job is something fantastic. He's like, look, he's not even one of my people. Look at what he does. Like, come on. He's great. And he's like, well, tell you what, you let me put Job to the test and we'll see how faithful he is to you. And that's when God and the devil make a deal. And God's like, you could do anything, but hurt him. Don't hurt him.
Yeah. Anything but kill him. But
yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, and that's just it. It goes down the rabbit hole from there with Job. Families die, crops die, everything dies off till he's sitting on a dung heap. And a bunch of people come by and they're like, look at you, man. You're like covered in boils. For God's sake, why don't you just finally blame God for this? And he's like, nope. Sorry. And eventually he breaks.
And he calls out to God. Right?
Yeah, he not just calls out to God, but he calls God out. And he's like,
right.
Yo,
what
man,
do,
what did I do to you? Ever? I'm not even one of your people, right. and then, I praise you. And God comes back, and he's right. like, hey, who are you? What, did you put the stars in their place? No, I did.
So what I'm going to read to you is God's response to Job.
All right.
Okay, and I'm going to decode it in real time. So this is Job 38:32. Job 38:32. The first thing God says is, he says, "Can you lead forth the Maseroth?" Now the Maseroth, okay, literally means the zodiac in Hebrew, okay? Maseroth over time becomes Mazalot, which survives in Judaism today as Mazel Tov. Okay? Or Mazel Tov means good fortune from the stars.
Yes.
So what is the Lord's challenge to Job? He says, can you bind the chains of the Pleiades? Can you loosen Orion's belt? Those are obvious star metaphors, right?
Sure.
Then he says, can you bring forth the constellations in their season or lead out the bear with its cubs? The constellations are the zodiac above, and the bear and its cubs are Ursa Major, the Great Bear, and yep. Ursa Minor, part of the Big Dipper. Who can tip over the water jars of heavens? That's Aquarius. Do you hunt the prey for the lioness and satisfy the hunger of the lions? That's Leo. who provides food for the raven? That's the constellation Corvus, which means raven and borders on Virgo. Do you watch where the doe bears her fawn? Mriga, meaning deer, is located in Orion. Who let the wild donkey go free? That's Acellus Borealis, which means donkey, and is located in Cancer. Will the wild ox consent to serve you? That's Taurus. The wings of the ostrich flap joyfully. That's Lambda Aquilae, or Al-Thaliman, which means two ostriches in Arabic. Do you give the horse its strength? It laughs at fear, afraid of nothing. It does not shy away from the sword. The quiver rattles against its side, along with the flashing spear and lance. That's Sagittarius with the bow and the arrow. Mm-hmm. Does the eagle soar at your command and build its nest on high? That's Aquila, which is a Latin name for eagle and is a constellation a few degrees above the celestial equator. Finally, he says, can you pull in Leviathan with a fish hook? And Leviathan is the fish god. So that's Pisces. So as you can see, his entire challenge to him is just encoded star metaphors.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And once again, asking him, like, can you do any of this? Because this is literally the firmament that I have put into place.
Right.
And I always found that interesting whenever you go back and look at ancient Hebrew and their idea of creation. It was the idea that there was a firmament, that these things were fixed. Mm-hmm. And that they were up above us. So it's always been interesting to see that. And even to hear God asking, like, are you the one that put the stars in their place? Are you the one that did that?
Mm-hmm.
But to take it to the point that you just did and start breaking it down astrologically is absolutely fascinating.
Thank you. I appreciate that. So there's questions that you can ask about Jesus. Okay. Mm-hmm. Some of the more interesting ones, how he's able to heal the blind, how he walked on water, how he turned water into wine, why he had 12 disciples, why he was betrayed with a kiss by Judas. We went over that. Why he was dead for 3 days. We went over that. Why is his birthday on December 25th? We went over that too. So let me go over the first parts, how Jesus was able to heal the blind. This is all the sun. Okay. Think about it. If he's the son, S-O-N of God, the man comes up to him, he puts his fingers on his eyes, he touches his eyes, and then suddenly he can see. However, when the sun goes down, you can't see anything. So when the sun comes up and touches your eyes, suddenly you have sight again. That's how it heals the blind. Okay. How he walked on water. Have you ever seen a sunset on a lake before?
Yes, absolutely.
The sun literally walks on the water.
Yep.
How he turned water into wine. So do you know why God is considered a man and Earth is considered a woman, Mother Earth?
Elaborate.
It has to do with his sacred fluid, God's sacred fluid, his rain. In Hebrew, it's called shemen. We get this word semen from it. Okay? So God's sacred fluid comes down and impregnates Mother Earth. And then from the rain, her belly grows full of fruit and food and trees and all this stuff. Okay? So now, you have April showers bring May flowers when you plant the seeds for the grapes, okay? That's Taurus. That's April showers bring May flowers. It rains and it rains and it rains. You plant the grapes. They grow and they grow. It continues to rain and rain and rain. And then finally in Libra, you pick the grapes and you turn them into wine. That's how you turn the water into wine.
Wow. All right. And with that in mind, because once again, there are people that trying to explain to them that what they know as the New Testament may not necessarily be what is, or that what they know as the New Testament may just very well be much like the Old Testament, a little bit of history mixed with a lot of allegory.
Mm-hmm. Because, I would even go further. I would say that none of the characters in the Old Testament were real. People like to point to King Solomon, right?
Sure.
Remember how I told you that it's all about 3 days? Jonah in the whale for 3 days.
Yep.
In the Jewish Midrash, Abraham actually sacrifices Isaac, and then he's dead for 3 days, and he comes back. It's always 3 days because the son dies for 3 days. Okay. The other thing too. Is that when you're talking about King Solomon, it's always talking about the sun, right? Solomon isn't a name of a person. Solomon is three words for the sun: Sol, which means sun in Latin.
Yep.
Om, the Buddhist Om, that means the sun. And On, O-N, was the Greek city of light in Greece. Heliopolis. Okay? Mm. That's why you have to turn the lights on still when you want to be illuminated.
Ah.
Okay? So that's where that comes from. So Solomon is just for three. And if you ever look at the blueprints, because they explain how to make Solomon's temple in the Bible. Okay?
Yep.
If you want to Google something real quick for your audience to see, I'll show you. Google Solomon's Temple blueprint.
Yep. Way ahead of you.
I can't see anything.
Oh, it's coming up.
Okay, keep going down. That one, up. That one in the middle. So this is a blueprint, okay? This is the blueprint for, you're going to have to maximize that. This is a blueprint, okay? Now, I'm going to explain to you what this actually means, because it's based off of sex magic. This is Solomon's temple. If you follow the instructions on cubits and how it's built in the Bible.
Yeah.
You have Joachim and Boaz. Now picture this as an above head view, okay? Joachim and Boaz are the testicles. The porch is the base of the penis. The holy place is the shaft. The holy of holies is the head. They have the ark, which is where all the DNA is stored. That's where your DNA is stored. It's a penis going into a vagina. If you turn this sideways 90 degrees, you'll see it.
Interesting.
This is based off of sex magic. Okay, the store chambers, that's the woman's vagina. Okay, that's what this is based off of. This is just sex magic.
Wow. Interesting. Which of course, this is the basis for just about most churches that you would walk into. Yeah. At least any church that celebrates a high mass.
Right.
You know, you walk into a Baptist church, definitely not the way it's arranged. There's no Holy of Holies. There's no tabernacle, anything like right. that. Even necessarily walking into a Presbyterian church, not the case. But whenever you're talking about a Catholic church, that is definitely when you're talking about like...
It's sex magic. Just rotate it 90 degrees. You can
narthex,
literally see it.
You know, pews, right. Altar... And if you're talking about old school church, especially Vatican I church, that is exactly where the tabernacle would be, the Holy of Holies.
Right.
In most churches nowadays, it is offset to the side. Because of the whole concept of the sacrifice at the moment being the miracle of the moment, not the static host lying in consecrated state should be the focus of the mass. And I'm sure that most of that was actually probably done to, you know, perhaps even hide the fact of some of the origins are from sex magic. Because for goodness sake, man, like it'll blow most people's minds whenever you go through and tell them like, feel free to attend a Catholic mass, then feel free to go attend a Jewish ceremony.
Right.
Like they're literally right. Other than us singing a few extra songs and stuff like that, pretty much the same thing.
Uh-huh.
Like the way that they're arranged, everything else. So even the ordination of Catholic priests goes into the order of Melchizedek.
Right. Jesus calls himself the, a priest of Melchizedek. He'll say he's always a priest of Melchizedek. And I actually decoded the book of Melchizedek.
Ooh.
With astrology, too. Maybe I can do it another time when I come on. It's not very long. There's not a whole bunch of it in there, but I could do some Gnostic texts, too.
Oh, we could do
the book of Enoch. We could do the book of Revelation. You know, my contention, and I prove this, I've done the book of Matthew, the book of Revelation, the book of Enoch, the book of Philip, the book of Thomas, the Mary Magdalene, the Gospel of Judas. I swear to God, you can go through any Gnostic. I've even done the Enuma Elish, which is the Babylonian creation story. Okay? That is still astrotheology. These are all encoded books. This is all the sacred books. All the sacred books are encoded with astrotheology. Okay? Because that's what it was. Because you needed to know the stars. You needed to know the stars, the sun, the moon. You needed to know all that stuff in order to survive.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, we take for granted that we have a, we take for granted that we have a watch or an iPhone that tells us the day, the time, the month. I can literally look at my phone, and aside from knowing whether it's going to rain or not, it'll tell me, I'll know the weather.
Yeah.
They didn't have that back then.
Yeah.
You know, remember how in Game of Thrones, they used to say winter is coming, because winter was a big, big deal. That was a big deal.
Yeah.
Because what would happen is, you know, people would get more sick. You know, the sun would not come out as much. You know, the nights were longer. The animals would come out. We were barely out of the food chain.
Yeah.
You know, and this is why this stuff was encoded. And then what happened is after the Council of Nicaea in 325 AD, this was basically perverted into a literal story.
Yeah, yeah. Becoming to bring. And that's what a lot of people don't understand is that pre-Vatican I, pre-Council of Nicaea, things like that, they were still, the whole purpose of that was the Arian conflict. You know, and getting rid of the whole, like, they had a few different camps of Christianity going on. There was, like, Arianism and that form going on over here. And they were like, whoa, 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 we got to get this straight. But
even further back, even further back, before the Council of Nicaea, Christians were called Heliognostics.
Yeah.
That was the name for them.
Yeah.
Okay, and Helios means sun in Greek. And Gnosis, knower.
Yeah.
They were sun worshippers.
Yeah.
Okay. And Constantine had a nephew named Julian the Apostate. Okay. His work still exists. And you can read them. And he's talking about bringing people back to sun worship. They got him killed in the battlefield. He had an arrow shot in his back.
Yep.
You know, but his work still survived. He was Constantine's nephew. His stuff's still here.
Well,
his works are still here.
And even once again, just to bring it back to that zodiac point, you were talking about Libra and everything else. I mean, Christ himself, that story is pretty much the echo of Dionysus, you know.
Yeah.
So and which is a whole nother thing about the concept of the water to wine, things like that. And I do not like discounting people's faiths. I do not like getting rid of people's faith, but rather I prefer educating people on their faith. And to understand this, now granted, that doesn't preclude the fact that there may have been a historical Jesus. But once again, these stories were conglomerated together in order to religiousize Christianity. Christianity existed, but it existed in sects, and it was not a cohesive teaching. Some sects follow, there were certain people, and even whenever they decided on what was there in the Bible, they pretty much went with what Orthodox Judaism taught. So with their Kabbalah, or their Gnostic texts, the things that they dismissed, didn't even make it into the Bible because they weren't part of the traditional Jewish teaching and that Jewish teaching.
Put it this way. During the Egyptian times, okay, they had hieroglyphs.
Mm-hmm.
They had countless hieroglyphs of bulls with suns between their horns. I mean, they're openly telling you that they're worshiping Taurus.
Mm, yeah.
Okay, the sun in Taurus, the age of Taurus.
Which would totally equate to the fact that anytime you see a bull represented, they have a sun in between their horns.
Right. Now, the Jewish people come up in Aries. That's when the Old Testament was written. Moses goes to Mount Sinai to get the Ten Commandments. Do you remember what he sees when they come down? When he comes down?
They have gone to the golden calf.
They've gone to the golden calf. Now, what is more likely? These are post-Exodus Jews. They couldn't even let bread rise. That's where we get matzah from.
Yeah.
They had to take everything and run.
Yeah.
Okay? So now, do you think they just gathered gold? And then when Moses went up there, all of them piled together hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pounds of gold, found welding equipment in the middle of the base of a volcano, and then just built a giant statue? Or it's a metaphor. The gold is the sun, and the calf is Taurus, the bull. The sun, they were worshiping the wrong time period. Moses comes down with the tablets, sees them worshiping the age of Taurus, realizing it's the age of Aries. He's supposed to bring them into the age of Aries, gets mad, throws the tablets down on the ground. That's where we get the phrase lawbreaker from, because he was the first one to break the law.
Yep.
Okay, and then he goes back up to get them. Now, the Jews are the people of Ares. They blow the ram's horn to the sky. They have a lamb shank bone on the Passover plate. Okay?
Yep.
Now, Libra is the judger, right? He's the judge, the judgment, because he judges God's son. That's why it's the scales of justice, law.
Okay.
Okay? All right? 8 days after Rosh Hashanah, which is the Jewish New Year, they have something called Yom Kippur, which is the Day of Atonement.
It's
the Day of Judgment. Okay, that's in Libra. Why is it in Libra? Because Libra is the judger. Okay, it's the Day of Judgment. The Jewish people go and they fast all day and they don't drink water all day, and then they pray to God to leave them in the Book of Life for another year. Okay, so now the Jews start to fade and Christianity comes up during the Age of Pisces. Okay, that's why you have the two fish in Pisces. That's why Jesus feeds the masses with two fish. That's why Jesus, the Jesus fish, the symbol of Christianity, Jesus fish.
Yeah,
that's the center of the Vesica Pisces. Okay, the Vesica Pisces denominator. Okay, the Vesica Pisces fraction is 247/153. Well, 153 is important because in the Bible, Jesus is walking alongside the lake, okay? And the disciples, after he was resurrected, and the fishermen are fishing, they can't catch everything because they're in the sign of Aquarius. He tells them to throw his net over the other side. Well, on the other side is Pisces. That's the fish. They catch fish. They catch fish. They count them out. It's 153 fish. These are all encoded metaphors that need to be decoded, okay? These numbers don't come in there by accident. So now the Jewish people disappear after Aries, kind of, and then the Christians come up. Now we're in the age of Aquarius. There's going to be a new world religion. There has to be, because it's a new sign. This, if you just follow the pattern, this is what happens.
And especially if you stay, and we've got to have you back on, especially to talk about this concept, because we've only got you for another couple minutes, and I've got to give you time for shameless self-promotion. But man, the one thing I have been shouting from the mountaintops is, good Lord, don't swallow the bait like bass under the boat when it comes to UFOs, UAPs, things like that in the story that's being told. There's a reason why suddenly the media started using the term UFO denier. Like it's a dirty word, like you're a conspiracy theorist if you're a UFO denier. You know, things like that. There's a different line being towed here, and it goes back to a conversation that I had with one of the first, like, big people in that world that I ever tried to get a hold of as a guest, who was like, listen, man, I don't come on shows anymore. I don't talk. I know more than one person that has been offed. I know more than one scientist that has died doing this research and trying to come out and say it. And I care about my family way too much. And he basically laid down the concept of Operation Blue Beam. If you're ever familiar with that, I know some of our listeners are, but the idea that they will either use, and they being world powers or the powers that be, dark government, what have you, will use either the guise of and use modern technology to give us the guise of either a false flag alien invasion or the second coming.
Right.
And it's interesting that you bring up that concept of the Age of Aquarius. Because once again, that's something that I warn people about all the time. Like, be careful, read into this, read more than what's there. Not that it hadn't led to great things, and it's not great things happening, but it's definitely something that you need to be wary of and that you need to keep your eye out for. So I want to thank you for coming on, for talking about this. This has more than piqued my interest for the evening, and I cannot wait to have you back on the show again. Tell everybody, before we let you go, of course, other than the Dudes and Beer and Curious Realm stores online and Amazon, where they can go to find out more about you, Micah, more about your research, and more about the Down the Rabbit Hole series.
So you can get it on Amazon. It's Micah Dank, Into the Rabbit Hole. It's Into the Rabbit Hole series. You can get it on Amazon. I'm on Facebook. I have a Facebook group, Micah Dank Into the Rabbit Hole. My Facebook is Micah Dank. My Instagram is Micah Dank, and my Twitter is Real Mr. Dank. So if you want to reach out to me or follow me, that's fine. I could send you some links of some other works that I've done. If you're interested in getting the book signed through me, I sell a ton of books, like so many books from my house. So if you're interested in getting those, you can do that. Just reach out to me, and that's pretty much it.
Great. Well, thank you so much once again. We will definitely be reaching out to have you back on. I definitely want to have you on again and again and again to talk about the idea of astrotheology, the idea of hidden astrological stories and meanings hidden in the Bible and other places, and what they mean and what their interpretation is in modern day society. So thank you so much for your time this evening. I greatly appreciate it.
Thank you. It's been great. Thank you.
All right. I'll talk to you soon.
Take care.
And while we connect with our other guest like that, that is just one of the many reasons why I love this show, why I love these conversations, because it's quite literally a whole new world whenever it comes to these things. While we connect with our next guest, the amazing and awesome Stephen Myers, let's check out this video about his theorem and the idea and hypothesis of the Great Pyramid water pump. Let's check this out real quick. Here we go. That our guest this evening, Stephen Myers, has put out there. I remember the first time that I heard Stephen Myers was on Coast to Coast AM, and it blew my mind, the information that he was giving out and putting out there about the creation of the Great Pyramid and what its possible uses actually were. Because if you start looking at archaeology, if you start looking at the purposes of hieroglyphics, if you start looking at ancient Egyptian culture, the pyramids, and especially the Great Pyramid of Giza, stands out amongst all others, not only because of its size, mass, location on Earth, portals, all kinds of wild stuff associated with it, but the fact that there are no carvings, no writings, nothing. And tonight we will be talking about the Great Pyramid water pump, the idea of the pyramid being built using a lock system, which of course the ancient Egyptians were master water sailing masters with sailing vessels, water, all kinds of things. Welcome back to the show. Stephen Myers, how are you doing this evening? Oh, are you there, Stephen?
There, is that better?
Hey, there he is. Hot diggity.
Yeah. Well, all this electronic stuff. I'm here.
All these buttons, man. I know. My life is one technical workaround. But welcome back to the show. I am so excited to have you back on. How have you been doing?
Oh, real good. What an honor it is to be asked back to your show. I mean, that's a thrill and a compliment to me, and I appreciate it. But well, I'm doing well.
I have appreciated your work, as I said, for a long time. These have been added to my library for a while. You actually kindly sent me some videos last time around, which were fantastic. And it was one of the first times that I've gotten to sit down and unabridged watch your work and get familiar with it. And let's start getting into the concepts that you talk about in your books and your videos, and the ideas of perhaps the pyramid was not constructed in the way that we think it was, and for the reasons that we think it was.
Well, the reason why we think a certain thing is because we were told a certain thing. Generally, by Egyptologists, tell us how the Great Pyramid was built.
Yeah,
but they have a lot of issues. They say that the precision stone cutting of, let's say, the casing stones of the Great Pyramid were cut using hand tools, you know, a hand like a Doriite pounder or a copper chisel, boop, 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 you know, and they made them all day long. But Egyptology is supposedly a science, but they don't demonstrate the process they say it was done. In other words, peasants and working people could make casing stones the way Egyptologists say it was done, according to Egyptologists, but Egyptologists can't make a casing stone in the manner that they say it was done. And the reason is that the extreme precision cannot be achieved using hand tools. You there?
Yes, yes. That's a theory held by a few people. Sorry, switching systems has gotten a couple things wonky, but we are here. And the idea, of course, one of my favorite things is following you on Facebook. And if you don't follow him on Facebook, you really should, folks, because he puts some great information out there. But one of my favorite things is your whole campaign against the Orion correlation, and the fact that because of the mere arrangement, even if it's an homage to Orion, that does not mean that it was made by extraterrestrial sources, that it was made for any uses, considering that, anything like that. As a matter of fact, it was probably more to the fact of what our previous guest was talking about, more along the lines of Orion being a marker in the sky for planting, harvesting, things like that.
Well, you mentioned the Orion correlation theory,
yeah.
And I do have issues with that theory because I think that it's based on some really flawed research methods. A lot of the correlations that they've come up with don't seem to have any viable causation to pair the two things they're comparing. And they also use some circular reasoning and some other flawed research methods. Before the Orion correlation theory, there was the biblical correlation theory, or pyramidology, which compared data points from the Bible with data points from the Great Pyramid. Like if you measure the Great Pyramid a certain way, then it supposedly predicts the birthplace of Jesus. And with the pyramid inch that they came up with, they use that inch to come up with the Great Pyramid, validating Bible prophecy. But that all of that's been rejected because it's just a bunch of hokum. It's a bunch of stuff made up that is based on flawed research methods. And I think that the Orion correlation theory is in crisis because it will follow the same fate as the biblical correlation theory.
Well, and, you know, I've definitely heard the biblical correlation theory, and I remember hearing that person on Coast to Coast AM many, many years ago, one of the researchers in that realm, talking about the Great Pyramid calendar, about the fact that there was this predictive and you see any time that you see some show with Nostradamus or the idea of predictions into the future, you always see it pop up on those shows, which I, of course, obsessively watch along with content like yours, Stephen. Because I do think it's important to be aware of such hypotheses. I have problems calling things like that theory, because of course you got to hypothesize before you get to the point of theory. And if you want to say something like that, that's a little bit out there and maybe disjointed and disconnected, feel free to hypothesize all day long, but don't call it a theory. Cause if you're calling it a theory, then at that point, it was already a hypothesis, and you've got some proof to the fact that now it's a theory. That's how science works. That's the scientific method.
Yes. Yes, a person should be very familiar with different ideas and theories and that type of thing, for a lot of reasons. You should be familiar with phrenology, which was the study or the correlations between bumps on people's heads and their character traits that are associated with those bumps. And that was taught in universities, and people wrote books, and people got degrees in phrenology. And the only thing is, it couldn't withstand the rigors of the scientific method, and it has been totally rejected. And that's one reason why the Orion correlation theory will never be taught in the university level, because they've already been burned by a correlation theory of phrenology that was total hokum. So, yes, you need to be familiar with various theories and with research methods. If you're going to be a researcher, don't research anything except for how to conduct research first. Then you can research something. Don't just make up correlations or think if something looks like something, it means something else or whatever.
Yeah, and I think that that's highly important to consider, because you, as we talk about on this show so much, and as you know, even being a member of the Dudes and Beer group, Stephen, it's about how we filter information. Feel free to take in any information you want. It's only a point of datum in a set of data. That's all it is. That's all it is. It's a point of datum and a set of data. So for it to crush a paradigm or destroy your world or destroy the way you think about the world or the universe or the way that it works, for something to be proven otherwise, even in science. I was literally going through the planets today. My son's almost 4 and I'm happy. He can name all the planets in order. It's great. We were going over them, and then he pointed way over to Pluto. And he was like, "And Pluto." And I was like, "Yeah, well, you know, I don't know, son." And we started talking about the concept of science and how, you know, science changes.
It does change.
My whole life, we had Pluto, man. That was a planet. And until about 8-9 years ago, when it became a planetesimal and something else, that's what every science book in the world said. Astronomy books. Everything. Now you had to go change all that. And do you remember the kerfuffle of Pluto?
I do.
When it happened?
Yeah, it was a big deal.
And I remember people. I remember, Pluto will always be a planet to me. It's like, but that's not science, yo.
That's true.
You can say it's always a planet to you if you want. It can be that in your heart. But that's not the science that we know now. And that's what you got to remember, is that science changes, science flexes. And what's interesting is when you even the methods of research in science, now the method itself doesn't change, but the empirical ways that we gather evidence does, as technology changes and flexes, what we even consider empirical evidence changes.
Oh, that's true. That's true. Before they had Geiger counters, they didn't collect data in that manner.
Yeah.
But a lot of people confuse data points with interpretations of data, you know, saying, you know, the Great Pyramid is a tomb is not data. It's an interpretation of data.
Yes.
So it's that, you know, the Great Pyramid, everyone says, well, what evidence do you have? Well, I have the same direct evidence that everybody has. But there are certainly different interpretations of that same direct evidence.
Well,
so.
And let's get into that real quick, because I've actually got the picture up on screen right now of you lying in the sarcophagus.
Oh,
In the king's chamber. And number one, I gotta just say, love the orbs in the picture. Or it could be a whole bunch of dust that's in the desert.
probably dust on the camera lens,
or even being blown about by the really cool, you know, hydrators in the side so that you can breathe in the place, you know?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. They have, some machinery in there making noise, but I had a chance to hop in the sarcophagus, you know, as countless thousands of researchers and tourists have done, including Napoleon.
Yeah.
And sat there for a photo shoot. And it is a kind of a humorous picture. I'm resting up after a lot of very difficult research.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, what's interesting to me, though, is A, solid granite all the way around. B, no carvings, which when you look, and I just brought up the general Google search for Egyptian tomb. Here is what a atypical Egyptian tomb looks like, folks. It has scrolls from the Book of the Dead all over. The idea, like we were talking about with our last guest, was that the soul continues on when it comes out. It's got to have these mystical writings there, even though they had them memorized, they had them there as spells for protection, spells to protect the tomb from getting robbed, spells to help protect them on their way into the afterlife so that they didn't forget the Book of the Dead on their way in, all that kind of stuff. So when you look once again at that image of a typical Egyptian tomb, even the ones where, like over here on the side on the discovery section of Google, where you see that the stuff is engraved in the walls,
yeah.
Great Pyramid tombs.
Yeah, they've got writing all over them on every surface. They had something to write down, but inside the Great Pyramid, it's no formal writing whatsoever. And I think the reason for that is it was a machine and certainly not a tomb. And it didn't need any writing.
Well, it definitely wasn't a tomb, because even Zahi Hawass, I think this is where you would get him in a corner. Because if it was a tomb, you're talking about, you're literally talking about something on the level of like the mummy, you know, where it's like they buried him without inscription so that he was lost to all eternity.
Yeah.
But we built this huge monument to him in honor, but then we cursed him in his own tomb so that he couldn't enter the afterlife.
Well, Egyptologists make up a lot of stuff, you know, just come right out of their hat in a way. They say the Great Pyramid.
That's a nice word for it.
Yeah. They say the Great Pyramid, well, it doesn't look like a tomb, but we presuppose that it's a tomb based on our authority. And the reason why it wasn't a tomb, it doesn't look like a tomb with all those chambers, is because they had several change of plans during mid-construction because they didn't really know what they were doing. That's what Egyptologists say.
Yeah, most people are aware of what they've been taught in school. which is the ramp method of construction. Either the biblical tradition, which is, you know, they were slaves that built the pyramid, or the fact that, you know, it was built by a bunch of workers and built utilizing huge ramps that either wrapped around it or went off like a mile into oblivion almost.
Yeah. Yeah. So, the Egyptologists have come up with this ramp theory of all these strong backed knuckle draggers dragging these stones up this big ramp. And that's a hypothesis, but they don't validate that hypothesis with any valid demonstration. In other words, the largest stones of the Great Pyramid are 70 tons. Egyptology, the entire science, has never moved a 70-ton payload.
Nope.
1 inch.
Nope.
So that's interesting to me.
And every, you know, probably about every decade, Stephen, you hear about it from National Geographic or somebody, or there's a Discovery Channel show or History Channel show where they get engineers together with a group of workers to even try to replicate in a scale, like a scaled size pyramid in a scaled amount of time, and they still can't replicate it.
No, because they're using methods that are impossible to duplicate what they're trying to duplicate.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Yeah, and most of that is just falsehoods. It's hokum because they move a 1.5-ton stone a few feet and then say that's how 70-ton stones were moved. Well, I can lift a full-size Chevy pickup just with my hands, just pick it up and just lift it up over my head. Mm. And the demonstration I use is by picking up a Hot Wheels car.
Yeah.
See? The issue of scale renders my demonstration invalid, just as Egyptology's issue of scale renders their demonstration invalid. So that's Egyptology is kind of a stagnated science, and evolving into a mystery religion.
Well, and, you know, much like we talk about not only in the group, but on this show regularly, Stephen, is the religion of science. And, you know, when you're talking about science, literally, like, Egyptology is one of the oldest sciences that there is.
It is.
As far as studies go and everything, like, Egyptology was happening right as we were discovering germs, man. Like you said, it goes back to Napoleon. Egyptology.
It does go back to Napoleon savants. You are correct. Yes.
And like we didn't even know about penicillin at that point.
No, we didn't. But you know, but Egyptology certainly has stagnated. A book written by an Egyptologist in 1900. Is not much different than one written now. I mean, they tell these stories about the big ramp and all of that, but no scientific method is used to produce any demonstrations.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's where my problem comes in, quite honestly, because I'm one of those people that, hey, I'm a believer in my heart of hearts, Steve, about a lot of topics, man, UFOs, all kinds of things, Bigfoot, Loch Ness Monster, dogs and cats living together, all kinds of things. But for me, because of the fact that I am a believer of believers, the empirical evidence must be greater. That's how I view it. Like my insistence upon evidence and scrutiny of the evidence is greater, and my understanding is the fact that only 2% to 5% of these things may be real.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what we should be exploring. And even though people like yourself have been hypothesizing and putting this out there for decades, it's still not even accepted as a hypothesis amongst people because they believe that this story has been written, and we run up against that religion of science. Yes. And especially, once again, the religion of one of
science,
one of the oldest sciences, Egyptology.
Yeah, well, they say science advances funeral by funeral. And, you know, it's was difficult. You mentioned penicillin. Alexander Fleming developed penicillin, but it took 40 years for that, or almost 40 years, for that penicillin to be accepted in the medical community.
That's right.
They said, oh, we don't need that, or it's too expensive, or it doesn't work.
What are you talking about, microbes? It's the ether.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, I said, and then the experts, when they first saw the Piltdown skull, oh, that's it. Missing link. It's right there. It's right there. They never even saw the file marks on the skull. So it took 40 years for the Piltdown skull to be determined to be a forgery, because that's how long it took those people that wrote their dissertations on the Piltdown skull to die off. So, yeah, science, especially the soft sciences, advance rather slowly. Just the way it is.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, earlier today, I actually posted on the Dudes and Beer group on Facebook an article from Big Think about a papyrus reveals how the Great Pyramid was built. And it was interesting because amongst all of it, they were talking about how, you know, there were L-shaped jetties that were built up north to hold the barges that brought huge blocks down, things like that, and also to park the barges that brought in Sinai copper, the metal that they used to, at least by their theorem, cut the stones. Now, and what was interesting was especially the ratios of cattle to pig and the number of, like, you know, high class people that were living there as opposed to just normal workers. Cattle being the food of the high class, and educated folk, pig being the food of the common folk.
What I loved
was them going into the fact that the pyramid boat were transported by boat from ports via canals to the construction site in Giza. And that they were master builders of such waterways for the purposes of irrigation. And I think that in and of itself brings us to the topic of your hypothesis and to the point of cracking the nut of that. Let's start getting into the idea of the Great Pyramid not being used as a coffin or sarcophagus holder or a tomb, but rather as a water pump, and even as a means to, as they were saying in the article, the masters of the irrigation system that they were, using it to irrigate the Giza Plateau.
Well, yeah, that's what I think, that the article kind of vindicated the direction of research that I'm on concerning this large structure that was built in ancient times.
That's why I shared it.
Yeah. Yes, that the Great Pyramid had a purpose, that it functioned as a machine, that it provided a huge return on investment instead of just ineffectively holding a dead mummy, but that this machine provided infrastructure that provided prosperity for the civilization that built it, and that was done by the Great Pyramid being a functioning water pump.
And that is, I think, where, because there are, once again, a few theories about the Great Pyramid and its uses. One of them, of course, being to shuttle souls to the constellation of Sirius, or to the star of Sirius, and the constellation Orion, all kinds of things. But I think, if anything, your idea of using this structure and the geometry of it and its location as a water pump to irrigate, because the stories of the time talk about them being hugely prosperous. The area was lush with growth. As a matter of fact, so lush with growth that not only bread, but beer were part of the daily staples of construction members' diets of the pyramids. Yes. So, like, when you're talking enough grain to produce beer on a mass scale to feed a work crew of, like, 20,000 people daily?
Yeah.
As part of their required ration for work and part of their payment? That's a lot of grain. That's a lot of grain. And not only a lot of grain, water. But a lot of water. Exactly.
Yeah. So they did have a yearly inundation in the Valley of the Nile, but a one-time irrigation event for a whole year is not very practical. So we think the Great Pyramid supplemented that year-round. It's interesting that the Aswan Dam stopped the yearly inundation, but a lot of its electricity is used as for hydro irrigation and things like that. So the Aswan Dam was seen as a better system than just in the yearly inundation. So quite in ancient times, they needed water pumps in the Valley of the Nile, and in modern times, they need and use water pumps.
And, you know, even here in Austin, a prime example, we are a huge limestone reserve, huge. And we have large reservoirs underground, everything else. And those, whenever they're drained or water table changes, things like that, leave decay systems. And one of the articles that I brought up is actually from a little while back. I'm trying to see the actual date of release here, but it's from NBC News. This is from 2009, August 14th, 2009. So almost 11 years ago, Stephen, this article came out about cave complex may lie beneath the Giza pyramids. This is literally that caves are caused by geological events like water erosion, things like that. So to even think that below Giza lies this now cave system where there may have been water at one point, things like that, where that water was absolutely pumped out and used. Like the same way that Nestle does any aquifer that they belly up to. You know? Like, no different. They found a source with a big dowsing rod and went right here, put the pump right here, and they drained it.
Yeah, well, there is a lot of passages and chambers all riddled through the Giza area, so it was certainly a great place to put a water pump, and it built right on solid bedrock, not on sand or anything like that. So it was a functioning machine, and the people that built it were geniuses.
Yeah. And I mean, even here now, granted, they're talking about it being an interest to the underworld, things like that. But the caves, which are tens of thousands of years old, if not hundreds of thousand years old, may have inspired both the development of the pyramid field and the ancient beliefs in an underworld. So
it could have. But that's that's interesting. You can delve into what the Great Pyramid symbolically represents, but if you're considering how it was built, there's no symbolism at all, you know.
Yeah.
The stones weren't moved symbolically or religiously or anything like that. So it's all a practical, real-world study as opposed to religion or what words mean or anything like that.
Well,
so I try to stay away from all of that, because anyone can come up with anything on what something means.
But
how a stone was moved is a whole different matter.
Well, exactly. And let's start getting into that because, of course – a lot of my listeners right now, Stephen, are like, Chris, but you talk about psychic powers. You talk about crystals, piezoelectricity. You talk about zero point energy and these systems and ancient technologies and things like that all the time. Why is it that you take Stephen's side in this? My reason is because, much like that article said a minute ago, the Egyptians of old were masters of water, of using water, pumping water, irrigating places. And to think that they would not, if they could even move the blocks from that far up river via barge once again, logically, why would you logically even take them off a barge
and drag them uphill? Yeah, no.
So no. Let's start talking about this lock system that you discuss so intricately in your videos, and your video series, and in your books. Let's start getting into the technology of the construction of the pyramids, and specifically the Great Pyramid, according to your hypothesis, Stephen.
Well, we think the builders were geniuses and provided a water supply at the Giza Plateau at the construction site. And the first stones that were set in place were the casing stones for the first level, you know, the casing stones that were right at the base. Mm. So with those stones set in place, you have a square wall where they were. And the original builders fill that square wall up with water. Those casing stones are cemented together watertight. So then you have a square pond about 4.5 feet deep on the Giza Plateau. They also built a series of water locks from the Nile River, which is close by, and all the way up to the building site, and the canals would actually go into that square pond. So they could bring stones on barges up the canals effortlessly, if you will, and all the way up into that pond. So they would essentially fill that pond with stones, move the stones, the interior stones, off of the barge and then down into the pond. And when the pond was filled, the first level of the Great Pyramid was completed. And then they put on the second layer of casing stones and another water lock to go up to that second layer, and then added additional water from the water supply, and were able to build the Great Pyramid level by level, including casing stones. So it was a systematic, fast production line assembly process, and it was just geniuses again that conceived and built this wonder of the world.
Now, specifically, what was it? Because, of course, you were talking about the ring of casing stones around the area, things like that. But what was it that first brought you? What was that, I guess, that Edison moment, that I guess not really Edison moment, because you do all your own work. But what was that aha moment where it was like, wait a minute, what about this? Because the idea of using water to transport these bricks to the Giza Plateau has been in the cards all along. But for some reason from there, everybody thought, why wouldn't they pull them off and put them onto this ridiculously large ramp and pull them on a steady incline all the way?
Well, I have an interest in history, usually on a technological level, but back in the day, you'd go to the library and pick out a book about the Great Pyramid, and then you would read, oh, yeah, the big ramp and the strong back muscles and the sweat and all of that. And then so I said, oh, well, you know, that's what the experts say. All I need to do now is see how they confirm it with their demonstrations. You know, like moving a 70-ton payload. But I found out something. Egyptology doesn't use the scientific method. So I thought, wow. Basically, they're describing a method that can't be done. And so I read other books, like about the Death Star, or the aliens can get all the way to the Earth, but they need the Great Pyramid to find their way back because it's a beacon or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Or the Bible, the prophecy correlations of star, you know, all of that. And then, but then I read a book, privately published book by Edward Kunkel, called Pharaoh's Pump. And he didn't talk about language or what gods were worshipped, but how stones were moved and set in place. And it was so much of an aha moment that I ultimately started a nonprofit foundation to further the direction of his research. And our foundation produced enough research that I was able to publish two books and also produce two documentaries. So we're furthering Edward Kunkel's work and, you know, giving tribute to him, but also the geniuses who built the Great Pyramid water pump.
Yeah, because, and once again, the concept behind the water pump, even if you look at an internal diagram of the Great Pyramid, is not incredibly complex. And whenever you start looking at the idea of a siphon, and using the, I guess, the throbbing of the water to siphon things in and of itself. Let's start getting into the technology of the pyramid as a water pump, according to this theory.
We think water entered the upper end of the descending passage, and other researchers think that there's a profound link between the Great Pyramid and water, including Christopher Dunn, who also contends water entered the upper end of the descending passage. But water went down into the oddly created subterranean chamber about 100 feet below the base of the Great Pyramid. And we think that it appears to be unfinished, but we think that the area that looks like it's unfinished in the subterranean chamber acted like a water break. So water came into that chamber from one side of it and then was caused to slow down on the other side, which created a large whirlpool in the area of the pit. And we think that they were using the property of water known as implosion. Victor Schrauberger, a 1930s naturalist, also did a lot of research on implosion, but that ultimately that caused water to go up through the grotto and into the lower end of the grand gallery. And that gallery acts like a large cylinder, if you will, even though it's not cylindrical. And in the upper end of that chamber, they used electrolysis to separate the water and into hydrogen and oxygen. Well, those two gases are quite volatile when ignited, and you can ignite that gas to create a vacuum. And there's videos on YouTube that demonstrate that. And the powerful vacuum was created in the upper end of the Grand Gallery, which pulled this water piston up. And then through some linkages and other mechanisms described in the book and my videos, that vacuum was broken or opened, if you will, which caused this huge, like 300-ton water piston to force water in the horizontal passage into the Queen's Chamber. And that compressed the air in the top half of that chamber and ultimately caused water to travel up into the King's Chamber and then out the King's Chamber vents. And then we believe that there were passages in the casing stones that are gone now that allowed water to move down from quite a height, a pretty good head, if you will, down and ultimately to their point of use. So it's kind of complex. There's some valves and check valves and that type of thing in the Great Pyramids. Some are still there, some aren't, but it's quite a process that I discuss in my books and also the videos.
Well, and you know, it's interesting because you bring out the you bring up the concept of the King's Chamber being used as a place where water was separated into hydrogen and oxygen. An explosive force was used kind of in the same way as a piston in a car. And at that point, and just looking at the diagram here, if you think about this, like the air, like a one cylinder engine, folks, and you're looking
kind at of.
The compression chamber right here and the water in and of itself and the pressure of the water is the piston. You can absolutely control the amount of oxygen coming in just like a carburetor through these two tunnels right there, which there are absolutely vents and spots to control that in those tunnels, correct?
Well, yeah, it's there's a lot of the Great Pyramid is like a puzzle with quite a few pieces missing.
Yeah.
And we, you know, try to recreate what was originally there, you know, thousands of years ago, part of the mechanisms that made the thing work.
Yeah.
Which are now gone, of course.
Yeah. And my favorite thing about that whole hypothesis about the King's Chamber being used as literally a compression chamber as like an explosive chamber, almost like a spark plug would be used to continue the explosive process of air and fuel being mixed. That would be air being added to the CO2, the electrolyzed CO2 and separated oxygen and hydrogen. But to see that there are actual signs of almost explosion inside the King's Chamber.
There is. Yeah, that's the only internal damage that wasn't caused by the hands of man. There was an expansive force, if you will, inside the King's Chamber, and a number of people have hypothesized the reason for that. We think that that chamber was half, the bottom half was full of water and the top half was full of air. Mm. And the air was like you could compress the air and then ultimately move water up the King's Chamber vents. But the coffer that I was laying in earlier, we think that was a system that kept the King's Chamber from becoming waterlogged. Mm. Total, you know, all that air absorbs into water, if you will. It needed to be replenished through a float system, kind of like in a toilet.
Yep.
But it was all automatic. But that system broke. And we think that because that broke, the King's Chamber became fully, completely full of water. And then it hydraulicked that chamber. And the massive forces involved expanded that chamber and also broke the ceiling stones in that chamber, and then the Great Pyramid water pump ceased to function.
Yeah. And, you know, even to look at that image of you laying there in what is known as the sarcophagus, it really does just kind of look like that is supposed to continue going up further than what it is. Even where it's broken off, it looks like it's supposed to go up further than that. And once again, to see those explosion marks, what looked like charring on the walls of the King's Chamber and in the ceiling, pretty phenomenal to see that. And
it is very interesting.
Now, when you were there and you were on site, what was it? 'Cause a lot of people are going to, of course, bring up the fact of, like, you're one of the only people touting this concept, Stephen. You and, of course, the founder of this research and the website and foundation that you've started since. But where is the possible evidence for this? Where is corroborating evidence in the Giza Plateau in erosion? Because, of course, that amount of water for that long, I mean, even using the construction materials that they were using, it would have taken a couple years to build this thing. You know, it wouldn't have been like a 6 month project. It wouldn't have been like us putting up a building in downtown right now where it's like, yeah, in 2 years, we're going to have this thing done. It's going to take a while, you know. They were barely using sail technology on those barges to get stuff downriver. So where in the surrounding area is the corroborating evidence? Because, of course, that's something that we got to talk about. Otherwise, we're just talking about more Orion and similar correlations, right?
Certainly, there's a lot of evidence for water on the Giza Plateau. When Herodotus was at the Giza Plateau, the 5th century BC historian, he was told that machines were used to build the Great Pyramid, and that they had short wooden planks. Some people say, oh, that's levers, but water locks have doors with short wooden planks. Also, Herodotus described the Great Pyramid as being like an island surrounded by water. So there was a retaining wall around the Great Pyramid, a square wall that existed up until the 18th century. Some of the early drawings by Napoleon Savant show that wall, but we think that impounded water. So it'd be like a great big island in a small lake. And of course, there's water erosion, both inside the Great Pyramid and that type of thing. You can just word search Great Pyramid, water erosion, and find a whole bunch of stuff to explore. Also, there were salts, primarily in the Queen's Chamber, but also in the lower half of the Grand Gallery. And those salt deposits, which have been cleaned off because the Great Pyramid's been cosmeticized, was like leaching from the limestone. And we think that that was exacerbated by the electrolysis in that area. So those salts were because of water, and people need to word search Queen's Chamber salts. And then you'll find, it was like a half inch thick, if you will. But and the Sphinx right by the Great Pyramid has a water erosion in the enclosure and a whole host of other things to consider. So just again, people can find out in the harbors right near the Giza Plateau. And there was also some sun ships, two matching very large boats, entombed right next to the Great Pyramid, if you will. They're being moved now to the new museum in Cairo. When I say now, I mean like yesterday, that these large, like 150-foot barges that are up on the Giza Plateau right next to the Great Pyramid have been moved. But we think those barges were used as like a floating crane. And that's described in my video series, how that worked. But a lot of, at least one translation of Herodotus' histories indicates that the Great Pyramid had an artificial duct connected to it. So back then, Herodotus may have saw something that's gone now. So that could have been either the water input or an output or something else. So there's a lot of types of evidence that indicate water was involved with the Giza Plateau, including the Great Pyramid casing stones are cemented together watertight. So that's quite interesting, too.
Yeah, I'm here. Sorry about that. There's a little bit of a delay between our systems tonight because you were the second guest hooked up through I had the first guest on via Zoom, you on via Skype. So there's a little bit awesome. Of a delay. So, but as I was just saying, there's a little bit to discount the fact that our ancestors were able to create this kind of technology, were able to do this, I think discounts humanity, discounts our intelligence. It doesn't have to be aliens. It doesn't have to be some insanely low. And I'm not discounting the fact that it could be some wildly lost vibrational or crystal or piezoelectric technology. I'm not discounting that. It absolutely could be. Most definitely. Who knows? However, I think the case is probably much greater for what you're saying.
I appreciate that. I've had a lot of people look at it and then they say, wow, that's kind of compelling that they used water locks and barges in this systematic method. It's interesting, in the 1830s, the Erie Canal was built about 4.5 feet deep. Mm-hmm. And the barges had a capacity of 70 tons. So in the 1830s, working people could easily move 70-ton payloads. Here in the 21st century, Egyptology cannot move a 70-ton payload. So yeah. I find that interesting.
Yeah. And, of course, people are like, well, the technology of the 1800s is totally different than that of ancient Egyptians. But, not incredibly, not incredibly. And when you're coming to how we moved things barge wise, ship wise, things like that, once again, yeah, like, hey, Archimedes was moving water up river with the screw up around the time of the just after the Egyptians, to think that and the Romans and Greeks moving water,
Romans, with their aqueducts, yeah, and everything else, yes,
absolutely,
that's for sure.
Even the accounts of Spanish explorers coming over to the Americas and finding the Aztecs in Mexico and Teotihuacan, and like, wow, this is some amazing utopia that you guys have built. Yeah. Like, this is more advanced than most of our cities. Like,
right, very sophisticated technology. There weren't any primitive civilizations. They all had high technology. And a lot of our medicines come from South America. Aspirin and other medicines that are derived from plants was being used in ancient times. But, now we synthesize those things. But still, it's pretty impressive. They did brain surgery in South America in ancient times.
Yep.
And C-sections in Egypt. So birth control, a whole host of things. So, yes, they had many high technologies, but they also were masters of physics, and they were able to move a huge amount of water in ancient times. Now, water locks, let me put it this way. You mentioned the magic wand or crystals or contemplating your navel or meditating to move stones or humming and all of those methods, and people mention those, but in the real world, which is where the Great Pyramid is, I think they used water locks. It's interesting that when they just recently expanded the Panama Canal, they didn't use any of those other systems like contemplating your navel or humming or a magic wand. They used water locks. So water locks are the 21st century choice to move our heaviest objects. We think that 21st century technology, not primitive at all, was used in ancient times to build the Great Pyramid very systematically.
Well, and not that complex at all, man. Like, go look at how North American Indians catch eels to eat. Like, they literally dam off a part of the river in order to do it. It's not rocket science or even ancient science crazy math to look at the way that water moves and figure that out. It's not hard. Like, kids build dams when it floods out of rocks.
Right.
So,
yeah, it's that type of a thing. So, but it's really interesting. And then people again say, oh, well, it flooded in the Nile, or they had the river right there. Why did they need a water pump? the water that's in the river is worthless for irrigation.
Mm.
So you got to get the water out of the river, you know. And where I live in a rural area, every farm is along the river with a big water pump.
Yeah.
So and the largest water pump in the world is in the Valley of the Nile. It's the Mubarak Pumping Station. Mm. You need to word search that right there by the Nile. They have the biggest water pump in the world. Why would they need that? Why would they spend $500 million?
Yeah, they got a river right there, right?
Yeah, they got the river right there. Why would they do that? You know, you could have called them up and said, hey, I can save you $500 million. You got the river right there.
Yeah.
You know, people need to find out how it is in the real world. You know, why people with $500 million spent that money to build the Mubarak pumping station. Because they needed to pump water, even in Egypt. So, I think the Great Pyramid water pump is a real world solution that they used in ancient times. And the Mubarak pumping station is a real world solution they used in modern times. Certainly they operate differently, but serve the same purpose.
Oh, most definitely. Most definitely. And that's just it. To go back and even read the hieroglyphs that are there, to go back and read the accounts, to go back and read the accounts of their sister civilizations who traded with them. They were a lush, rich civilization. There was some famine that happened on a cyclical occasion. I mean, sure, the whole Moses situation wasn't really pretty. but aside from that, things were lush and bountiful in Egypt. And it was because they controlled irrigation. They flooded the plain. It wasn't a naturally flooded plain. They absolutely controlled that. And to know that the accepted science is that they quarried the rock miles upriver and brought it down by a barge.
400 miles. Yes.
Yeah. Why would you skimp that last mile and a half? literally, you know, mm-hmm. That would be like me as an engineer with a crew of people unloading 18 wheelers onto carts with wheels to take it across a hotel. And then the last floor of it, instead of taking the elevator going, okay, let's take it all off the wheels and just walk it right up those stairs, guys. Yeah, but there's an elevator there. Nah.
Right. Yeah.
Stairs are just as good. Just take it up the stairs.
Yeah.
But we've been using the elevator. So, just take it up the stairs. Even though the elevator is available and you know how to control the elevator and you know how to use the elevator.
Right. But I know where you're coming from. It's a marvelous system. The Erie Canal was able to move the weight of the Great Pyramid 600 million tons in 2 years.
Wow.
So it's water locks are fast.
Yeah.
And they are powerful and controllable. So it's interesting explanation for the direct physical evidence that we all have. And a lot of people feel that, I get people every day, you know, that's read my books or heard a talk show or found out about the research and say, hey, you know what, believe it or not, it makes sense much more than what Egyptology says.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, when you're getting down once again, just to the straight point of logic, every single method that has been described by Egyptology or been the accepted mode given by science has yet to be able to be proven. Now that and on a scale basis, that's like, hey, let's build a pyramid that fits in this room in a scale amount of time that it would have taken them to do it on that scale. Now granted, is this something that you have considered and a challenge that you would consider taking on would be to try and scale this down to like 10 by 10 size? you know?
Certainly not. Water locks have been, you know, demonstrated to work.
Sure.
You know, thousands of times a day for a long time. So we don't have to demonstrate that water locks operate. Certainly, we think that this water pumping system is unique and valuable. We think it would be an alternative, certainly, to hydroelectricity, an alternative to fossil fuel generated electricity, that type of thing. Sure. And we're trying to redevelop this ancient technology for our modern but very troubled world.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, to be able to hook up generators to this would be phenomenal. Right.
If you could pump water cheaply, you can use that pumped water to, like, irrigate farmlands, but also to power machinery, generate electricity, and a whole host of things. It would be very valuable, especially in third world countries, where they could build these types of water pumps in a cottage industry, if you will. Sure. So we're, again, trying to develop this ancient technology, which is energy efficient and non-polluting, to help, you know, on a humanitarian basis, if you will.
Yeah,
so that's part of our nonprofit foundation's goal.
Well, and the great thing is being able to source materials locally, being able to source rock locally, things like that, and once again, build it on the scale. Because, of course, building something on the scale of the Great Pyramid would be absolutely insane. But building something that could support a village of a couple few hundred people that would be able to fit in the equivalent of a backyard.
Yes.
That's totally different.
That's what we're trying to do. You don't need a big stone pyramid by any means.
Yeah.
We're using PVC pipe, polypropylene, containers, that type of thing. Also some custom fabrication and some other things. And that's the most funding intensive aspect of our foundation's work. And that's what we're doing. Hopefully people can visit our website to find out more at thepump.org and find out, what we're doing, our mission statement, progress and activities. We were going to go on a tour to Egypt in February, but it was canceled because of COVID. And that tour hasn't been rescheduled yet, but people can keep checking in to find out when that tour will be rescheduled.
Yeah. And, as you know, I'm a live AV technician by trade. So it's a sad thing knowing that tours like yours are canceled, shows and conferences that you would normally be speaking at, even as a remote guest, things like that are canceled.
Yes.
It can be challenging to get the word out about these kind of things. And I'm so happy to be a voice for you, to be able to give you the ears of my audience, to be able to give you one more platform, to be able to get this research out there. I think it's so important that if we look once again at just the sheer concept of physics of siphons, straws, things like that, and the diagram of the Great Pyramid, and the way, even whenever you look at subterranean chamber, with the huge straw that looks like it would be going down into what would be like an untapped reservoir or something like that.
Yes.
So entirely incredible to be able to provide that kind of technology on a micro scale, instead of the macro scale that it is at the Great Pyramid, to be able to provide clean drinking water to people, be able to provide, even at that point, with the same system, power generation, pulling turbines inside of the system, things like that. So many different possibilities from this, once again, ancient technology of the Great Pyramid. So thank you once again for coming on, for being a guest, Stephen. I can't wait until your next appearance. It's always so exciting talking to you about this stuff, and I guarantee you it will not be a year before your next appearance.
Oh, wow. Well, I appreciate this opportunity, and I just ask people to find out about you know, the direction of research before they pass judgment. And certainly, if you're told something by an Egyptologist, take it with a grain of salt. Egyptology is the biggest hindrance to understanding ancient Egypt.
Wow.
So, again, wow. Thank you.
Oh, man, that... You're once again absolutely welcome. The idea of Egyptology being the largest hindrance to the study of ancient Egypt is pretty incredible. And like we could do an entire whole episode on that in and of itself, because it really is, once again, one of those scientific religions. It's no less a religion than the cults that they were following in ancient Egypt themselves, folks.
Yes.
So,
yes.
Once again, Stephen, thank you so much for the work that you do at the Pharaoh's Pump Foundation, all the research that you have done into this, the videos that you have put out, the books, all the work over the many, many years, and thank you for always responding on the group and for being a guest on the show.
Well, great. Yeah, my website is thepump.org. You can go to my YouTube channel, which has a lot of videos, also my Facebook page, and my books are available through links at Amazon. So find out more, and I hope everyone does the research they need to do to find out what they want to find out.
Absolutely. Please do hold the line while we close things out here real quick. While you are online checking out all the great work of the Pharaoh's Pump Foundation, please do make sure to stop on by dudesandbeer.com. Dudesandbeer.com is where you can find all the episodes. Make sure to stop on by our mother website, HC Universal Network. And also, call to action. Make sure to Google Curious Realm this week, at least once. I don't care if it's now. I don't care if it's tomorrow. I don't care if it's Friday while you're having a beer. Google Curious Realm. That is our new incarnation coming to you in December. Till next time, take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. Keep reaching for 11. Can't be good. Be good
at it. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Dudes and Beer Podcast. To listen to our audio streams or chat with us live, download the official Dudes and Beer app for Android and iDevices, available on Google Play and iTunes markets. For more episodes, content, and information, visit us online at dudesandbeer.com. You can also find our episodes on Breach.tv, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, SoundCloud, iTunes, YouTube, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast service. Dudes and Beer is a proud member of the HC Universal Network family of podcasts. For more about our sponsors and other podcasts on this network, visit hcuniversalnetwork.com. Thanks for listening, everybody, and until next time, drink responsibly.